Today's program is brought to you by Austin East Ciders. For more information, visit their website at austineastciders.com.
I'm Erica Wides, host of Let's Get Real, the cooking show about finding, preparing, and eating food. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Nation, your weekly wine journey. Today, our guest is Kimberly Prokoshin. She is the sommelier, head sommelier at Rebel in New York City. She curates probably one of the most interesting and extensive wine programs in New York City. We're going to talk to Kimberly about sommeliers and wine. Kimberly's going to stay with us for our weekly wine sip. We're going to taste the Morgon from France. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation. We bring wine to the people. All right. So, what is a sommelier? What is the role of a sommelier in a restaurant or a wine bar? Does the title intimidate you? How can a somm heighten your drinking and dining experience? We'll ask Kimberly, 2015's Wine and Spirit magazine's Best New Sommelier and Head Sommelier of Rebel, located in the Bowery in Manhattan. Kimberly, welcome to the Grape Nation.
Thank you for having me.
Happy to have you here. So let me just set the agenda up for you. I want to talk to you about the role of a sommelier, and I think you can help us with that. Mm-hmm. I want to talk to you about Rebel, because the reason I asked you here is I think it's probably one of the most interesting wine bar and restaurants in the country, probably. I want to talk about the wine scene in New York, and I also want you to point us out to what wines we should be drinking now. But before we get to that, I want you to tell us a little about you and your journey, how you got to Rebel. I'm sure it required certain things. So go ahead.
So hi, everybody. I arrived at Rebel kind of by accident. I have worked in restaurants for over 10 years now. I'm going on my 11th year in New York. I had done catering and stuff when I grew up in Connecticut. When I moved to New York, I lied my way into my first restaurant job.
Which was where?
I was on 2nd Avenue and 7th Street at Virage, little French bistro that's still there.
How old were you?
I was 19. So.
Okay. So technically you weren't even legal drinking age.
Oh, yeah, definitely not.
Okay.
Definitely
I like
not.
That.
But yeah, I actually lived on Rivington Street between Bowery and Christie, so kind of full circle. I'm back working like a block away from there. But yeah, I moved into a studio apartment with a couple friends, and there were four of us living there, splitting a $1,600 monthly rent, and I worked at Virage, and it was kind of, I had a dream of moving to New York, and restaurants seemed like the best way to fund that, and I had always liked working with food, doing catering. It's not really high caliber stuff, but I loved the perks of getting to eat afterward and, you know, the camaraderie that comes with the people you work with. And actually working the events was always really fun. So it just seemed natural that I'd move into restaurants. So I worked at Virage.
How long were you there?
I was there for, I think, a year and a half or 2 years. When I decided to go back to school, I was a little burnt out. I had been working 60 hours a week.
Did you go on your own, or did your parents make you go back to school?
No, I went back. I did go on my own. I wanted to finish college, and I was taking art classes at Hunter, and I had already done 2 years, so I figured I might as well finish. And brunches were burning me out, and doubles and everything, and I was like, ugh, enough. I'm done with restaurants. I'm not going to do it anymore. Yeah, but I loved working there.
What happened after Virage?
So after
Virage school.
Yes. So then I went to school, I eventually finished school. I worked a bit doing retail stuff, and I ended up hating it. So I kind of realized I needed to maybe make my way back into restaurants. I worked at a cafe on Prince Street where I ended up meeting my future husband. And then the crew there, it was a really casual place, but the crew had worked in fine dining, and it was the first time I kind of got a taste of what career service people looked like. And then
that appealed to you?
It appealed to me, but it wasn't really until I made my way to I kind of got poached to work at this place called the Bowery Kitchen that was there in the space that Pearl & Ash now is. So right. I worked there for the 3 months that it was open or so, and then I was there when Pearl & Ash.
When you took the job, did you have any idea that it was on its way out?
No, it opened. It opened in August and it closed November. So I was there for the beginning and the end and then the beginning again. So, but that was also, you know, it was a very different place than what Pearl & Ash became. But I loved to cook at home at that point. I didn't know a lot about wine. I was just spending most of my time cooking at home and playing around with flavors and things like that. And I was reading a lot about, you know, different memoirs from people who were mostly chefs and, working or, you know, farmers. And, I remember I watched a documentary about, Paul Liebrandt, and then the day after, they had Richard come in and he was going to be the new chef. And it just so happens he had been in that documentary, and it was sort of this serendipitous thing where I was like, I felt that there was this feeling of things changing, and the people coming on board liked how I worked and they kind of took me under their wing.
When was the defining wine moment?
Actually, for me, the first defining wine moment was with a natural wine that's from the Loire Valley. It's called Patapon from Brissou. It's a Pinot Dionis. I remember that was quite a little while after, but maybe a few months into Pearl & Ash being open, I was helping Patrick on the floor, and he had me taste that. And it's
Patrick is Patrick Capiello. Yes. Patrick is the head sommelier of Pearl & Ash and Rebel. At that point, you weren't dedicated to wine. You were just at the restaurant.
I was whatever they needed me to be, pretty much. But I was working as a server and then spending a lot of time doing whatever else needed to be done to keep the restaurant
open.
So
when did the wine, when did you focus towards wine?
Well, that was really Patrick and Brandon kind of, they saw something in the way that I was interested in what they were doing I gravitate towards service and hospitality in that way, and they kind of told me, maybe you should think about doing this for a career, because beforehand I had no idea what a sommelier was, that it could be a career.
Did you say to yourself, oh yeah, maybe I could do
this? Yeah, I was like, ooh, I can do this? Okay. I will definitely do this.
They took you under their wing?
Yep, they did. So they,
at that point, it was an in-house wine education.
It was pretty much
experience.
Patrick has definitely been my mentor through and through. So.
So you became the head sommelier at Rebel.
Yes.
Which is an incredibly wine-centric place. When did that happen?
So we opened a year and a half ago, about 6 months, I think, before opening, I started phasing myself out of Pearl & Ash. Eventually, I had been working as a sommelier on the floor at Pearl & Ash.
So by the time you were phasing out Pearl & Ash, you were already sea legs.
Definitely. I think it's been 3 years since Pearl & Ash, since Pearl & Ash has been open. So 6 months into Pearl & Ash being open, I started working under Patrick, receiving orders and processing wine and just doing all the grunt work that was needed to maintain a really, really intense wine program, because at that time it was only Patrick. So I started working with him, and then
Patrick was doing
everything.
Rebel and Pearl &
Ash. No, well, Rebel opened after Pearl & Ash.
After, okay.
So at the time, Pearl & Ash was the baby. It was the only restaurant there. And it was, you know, it wasn't even intended to be his full-time thing. He was started as a consultant. And it just grew into this amazing, well-received program from the rest of the wine industry and wine geeks. Everyone kind of flocked there. So it grew into something bigger than I think anyone could have imagined.
You got that cred from the industry.
Yeah. Well, you know, you make it interesting, and I guess people will come. So
we'll get to the wine program at Rebel and sort of what you do on a daily basis there and talk about the program. But I want to talk to you because you really came up through the grassroots. I want to talk to you. I want you to tell our listener when they walk into a restaurant, I want you to tell them, what is a sommelier?
Yeah.
Your interpretation.
Yeah, I mean, I like one of the things Patrick has always told me, especially when I first started, he didn't want me to get too big of a head. And he's like, sommelier is a wine waiter. So I kind of, as a base, as a foundation, I think it is a good reference because we're sort of sommelier, you're serving guests who come into the restaurant first and foremost. You are also serving the producers and kind of being advocates and voices of the producers of the wines that you're serving. So it's important to be open and gracious, but also knowledgeable about what you're providing and being able to you know, make it a fun experience where, you know, hopefully the guests can learn something, have a takeaway, but also just really enjoy whatever it is they're drinking.
So I think wine waiter is a good term.
Yeah, I do.
Because your waiter will run you through the menu and tell you the specials and the ingredients.
Exactly, a guide.
You take that specialty, mm-hmm. you know, as far as what the wine is. I know that Rebel is sort of a magnet for wine geeks, mm-hmm. and you see that all night, all week. But I'm assuming that they're just regular people that come in, are, you know, adventurous, and, you know, I'm sure that happens. How can a sommelier heighten and enhance a customer's experience? You know, what is it that you'll do, you know, when you stand over a customer and try to help them? You'll have people like me that think they know everything and know a little, and then you'll have people that don't know anything but are adventurous. How do you enlighten that experience? How do you enlighten and heighten that experience?
Yeah, I mean, I think one part of the job is understanding people and being able to read a guest within just a few seconds of interacting and kind of, you know, depending on the night, maybe they want, you have to understand what kind of experience they want because you don't necessarily, you know, if you're out with your parents or it's going to be a different experience than if you're out with like business
bunch
people
friends,
or and it also is personality. So,
eyeball the situation.
Yeah, I eyeball the situation.
Like this guy's here with his grandparents.
Yeah.
Or this guy's here with his business workers.
Or
two different kinds of service.
And depending, you know, what kind of wine drinker they are, too. So if they're into something that's funky and offbeat, or if they're into something that's more classic, what do they usually like to drink? Where
so you go
them?
Through a series of questions.
Yes, definitely.
You know, red or white, what do you like? Mm-hmm. What do you normally drink? You could find out how experimental people are.
Yeah, and especially even based on if you ask them, like, you know, is there a region that you really like to drink from usually? And depending, you can kind of understand how much somebody knows, not in a way where you're judging them, but just understanding how, like, I wouldn't take somebody who's normally, you know, comfortable drinking California Cab to maybe some, you know, Pinot Dionis from Loire. It's completely opposite and doesn't make sense. So you have to have, like, the train of thought has to progress. And
so if the person knows virtually nothing about what they want, you have to sort of build up. Through a series of questions, you know, what do you like? Is that difficult? Do you ever get frustrated?
No, I think I like it, which I think is good if you're a sommelier, that you like kind of doing
that.
It's
that's
sort of
part of the
it's
challenge.
It's like almost like investigative detective work, 20 questions, kind of dissecting down a lot of information in just a few moments. Because, you know, if it's busy, which often it is, you don't have so much time either.
Who's the tougher customer? The know-it-all who thinks he knows it all, but you know doesn't really know it? Or the guy who doesn't know anything and it's just hard to get out of him? I mean, what's the more fun challenge or what?
I really enjoy talking. I enjoy talking with all sorts of people, but it's super fun to talk with people who are interested in wine but don't have the know or the vocabulary to really explain exactly what they're looking for. So it's almost like you're doing translating together, and it's kind of fun. I like that.
Do you ever have trust issues? Like people worry, oh, this woman's going to bring me out a really expensive bottle of wine. Or,
oh, for sure. I mean, more
how do
like,
you calm people down that way?
I think, it's less with me. I look kind of young and I'm small. So a lot of times people.
You're not intimidating.
I'm not intimidating.
It's like, she'll be fine. Here's a 61 Latour.
Yeah, they're like, are you sure you're the sommelier? Are you sure? Like,
So your whole presentation puts people at ease.
Yeah, or they have. I have to just. I think, you know, I feel like now I've done it enough times that I feel fairly confident usually when I'm tableside. So I think confidence is really key. When I first started working on the floor as a sommelier, I definitely was scared of the big wolves, the guys who have a lot of money or who will spend a lot of money on a bottle and want to get your
toothpaste. Did you feel they felt they knew more than you?
Oh, yeah. And they probably did. I mean, to be honest, it's like sometimes there's guests who know more than you, and I've learned a lot from those people just remembering what they drink and how they progress. Right. And so I think, enough times of like going through the pain of working with people like that, now I feel pretty comfortable.
Do you find yourself going through a series of common questions throughout the night and the week? Like, do you ask people how much do you want to spend, or is it as obvious as are you drinking red or white tonight?
Yeah.
Are you adventurous? I mean, do you find yourself, is that part of the repertoire of questions you'll ask people?
Yeah, definitely. I kind of start broad and then I go more detailed. So, I'll ask, like, you know, so you're thinking about doing a bottle, great. You're looking into, what are you thinking? Do you want to do red, white, sparkling? And then I kind of look to see, do you want to do something that's like fruitier? Or actually, I'll probably, fruitier or earthier, lighter, fuller bodied, medium bodied. And then I kind of like.
You'll throw out all the adjectives.
Yeah.
People go, oh yeah, earthy,
simple.
Fruity.
Yeah. And then I like my favorite, where I get a lot of information is if people, like, what do you usually like to drink? Is there a region you really like or a grape you really have enjoyed? Do you have a picture of anything you've had recently that you really liked? Because then it kind of gives you an idea of style. You can kind of, it reminds you of another bottle that you've had or something. And
So in baseball, there's batting average. Mm-hmm. How many times you hit the ball. Mm-hmm. In sommelier, I guess how many times you get the right wine into a person's glass and mouth. Do you run into instances where people say to you, this is not what I wanted. This isn't what.
Yeah, does it happens.
Not often, though?
Less and less, knock on wood, as I've been working. But it does happen. I mean, I remember it. I mean, more like when I first started on the floor, but it's happened. I had a guest ask me. They were looking at, what were they looking at? It was Fantino Barolo, like 1998, and Hirsch Bohan Dylan Pinot Noir 2013. So two actually like pretty different wines. And so I kind of, Patrick was away, and usually at that point he and I were working on the floor together often. So I had to kind of make the call on my own, and I was like, do the Nebbiolo. It's awesome. It's great. And he was like, I served it to him. He's like, this is dried out. And like, you know, there's no fruit here. It's like all spice and there's nothing. And I was like, and you know, Patrick came back and he's like, well, the first thing you have to realize is like, those wines are really different. So maybe you want to figure out
the expectation.
What is it they're looking
that
for?
That particular wine wasn't drier off. It's just the profile of a Barolo compared to the guy's expectations.
Right.
It just didn't.
No.
He wanted probably a little sweeter, fruitier.
Yes.
What'd you say the other wine was? A Hirsch Pinot Noir?
Hirsch Pinot from Sonoma. And I think, so I've kind of gotten the habit of, you know, if people say, we're deciding between these two wines, I'll kind of be like, well, this one's going to be more like this, and this one's going to be more like that.
Do you play food into the decision? Like, what are you eating?
We do, but it is a little, it's definitely less than other restaurants where they do pairings, because if anyone's looked at the list, it's very heavy with bottles. So there's not a lot of by the glass pours. So I'm really helping guests pick out a bottle that's going to work well with their entire meal, or you know, starting with something, moving into there. So it's important, and I wouldn't, you know, there's certain things I would say you probably shouldn't do, like you know, some full body cab with the light hake dish, but if you like, but at the same time, if you like that kind of thing, maybe you would hate to do a white, maybe you hate white wine. So we can find some kind of equilibrium.
So let's put a cherry on top of this. So what's the best way to describe with a bunch of adjectives what a good sommelier is? What are, you know, the elements?
I think, well, they have to, I think the best somms are ones who can relate to people. And because, like I said, you're relating to the guest and you're relating also
so to the winemakers. So arrogance and being a know-it-all. Not good.
Yeah, not good.
What else?
And openness to learn. There's always more to learn in terms of wine. There's so many regions, so many wines, so many grapes, so many years. Like, there's just a lot to remember and a lot to, to learn. I think patience is important, too. There's
on your part?
Yeah. Well, I mean, because you're doing, a lot of different kind of work and dealing with numbers and also like an inventory and bins and all of those things.
Right. You didn't talk about the business part of it,
yeah.
Which is meeting with wine people, distributors, inventory.
Keeping
the,
yeah.
There's a whole business side to that.
Yeah.
But that we'll come to that in another time. All right. I want you to tell me about Rebel and the wine program there. I'm very interested in it. It's, I last time I looked at the wine list, it was 80, 90 pages long. Is that correct?
Yep. Yeah. Yeah, it's like 99, right? But there's the table of contents and by glass. So
all right,
I think
so
about 90, yeah.
Okay. So tell me why it's so long and what's on it.
Okay.
What's the compulsion to have? Because that's a big wine list.
It's a big wine list. It is. But so, like I've said, so Patrick's he's taught me pretty much everything I know, and so he comes from like a lineage of long wine lists as well, working at Veritas and Tribeca Grill, and Gilt's later.
Those
he created
all...
his own. Yeah. So those were all really long wine lists, and I know when he first started with Pearl and Ash, he initially told. Spoke with the owners, and he's like, well, if you want me to come on, it's got to be a long list. Like, it's going to be long. That's what I do.
And they agreed.
And so I think it's the way that I've learned to do it. And what it allows is we have a lot of verticals, mostly verticals from different producers. So when I say verticals, I mean, like, you have the winemaker, and then you have all the vineyards or a bunch of the vineyards
successive vintages.
And so it really allows, should someone choose, to kind of work their way through the different expressions of a winemaker's like.
Right. What the list is composed of a concentration of certain regions,
yes.
Right? Which
so
are?
It's exclusively French and American,
okay.
Whereas Pearl and Ash is an international wine list. So when Pearl and Ash it's more modern American kind of cuisine, and the list encompasses pretty much anything. Whereas when we open Rebel, it's a American French restaurant, so it's a French restaurant done by Americans who really love France. And
there was a term used describing the restaurant called bistronomy.
Yes.
Which is sort of a new wave, new age French food bistro. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I hope I
don't... And that serves the list well.
Speak against what Danny, our chef, he's, trying to... what he's doing. But he comes from Spring in Paris.
Which is an American in Paris.
Yes, American in Paris.
And that's Daniel Eddy.
Daniel Eddy. And
and you received a Michelin star for Rebel?
Yes.
Big
he did.
Deal.
He did. Yeah.
So you have a Michelin star and a 90-page wine list.
Yeah.
How are you not going to have a good time? Right? I mean, really.
Yeah.
So the French portion of the wine list, break it down for me. You have your Bordeaux's.
Yeah.
Your Burgundies.
Mm-hmm.
Rhone.
Yeah.
Where does the rest of the list go? I'm sure it doesn't. I'm sure there's a lot of bottles of that, but what else?
Yeah, so we have we have Loire, Savoie, Jura.
Where is Savoie?
Savoie is kind of in the Alps area. It's sort of in the southern, a little south west of the Jura.
Okay. The Jura is where?
And the Jura is
Don't tell me northeast of Savoy.
It's right. near Switzerland. So it's another sort of, it's like a mountainous
right.
Area as well. Mm-hmm.
And the American wines, I'm assuming you have a lot of the famous California winemakers, Sonoma, Napa, cult wines. But have you spread out and looked for interesting wines from the U.S. too?
Oh, definitely. I mean, we have a pretty large selection of Finger Lakes. We have some North Fork, so from New York, both those regions. And then, Oregon, of course, Washington. We even have from Arizona. And we've had from Idaho in the past. I don't think it's on right now. But and in terms of California, we have some of your expected regions, but there's a ton of smaller regions too that are getting more credit, and a lot of smaller winemakers who are seeking out older vineyards
right.
and really looking to create wine that's.
So I'm sure there are more winemakers that want to be on the list than you put on the list. As large as
Probably.
The list is.
Yes.
So take a region, because it's around the corner, like Long Island.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you have a few dozen wineries there.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing, because I don't remember from looking at the list, that you don't have every Long Island winery on.
No, we actually...
Taste through and curate and decide.
Yeah.
Like any other wine.
Yeah. And there's a lot that, I would like that come on the list, that rotate in and out. It's about deducting.
Same thing with the Finger Lakes, mm-hmm. I'd guess.
Yeah.
There's some rock stars in every region and then some solid producers.
Yeah, definitely.
Great. Mm-hmm. All right, I'm going to do my Joan Rivers. Can we talk about Burgundy?
Yeah.
I want to talk about Burgundy for a minute because your list has a lot of Burgundy. And we don't curse a lot on this show, but there's a lot of heavy shit on that list. And Burgundy tends to be a wine, especially to my listeners, that is not accessible, highly allotted, very mm-hmm. collectible, and expensive. So the average guy ain't drinking a lot of Burgundy. What I want you to help me with is how can we inform our listeners how to drink Burgundy on a budget? Is that possible?
Yeah, it is.
So walk me through regions, wine specifics.
Sure. If you're looking to, as far as like drinking Burgundy.
Keep the price down, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know how easy it is to do, but I think producers in Burgundy are key first, having a few producers that make really great quality, and they, since in Burgundy they work in several different subregions of the region, you can often find good value in like Bourgogne is kind of the beginning.
Bourgogne.
Yes.
So Bourgogne is a region of Burgundy.
Well, it's a general AOC, so it can be from any area of Burgundy. Burgundy is separated down into it's like there's tons of villages. So,
right.
But Bourgogne can be from any of those villages.
Bourgogne is a value-priced red wine mm-hmm. from the Burgundy region from a variety of the makers.
Yes. One that I like a lot is from Pierre Moret. Pierre?
Moret. Spell it.
M-O-R-E-Y.
Okay. And he makes a Bourguignon?
Yeah, it's actually his daughter, Anne Marie. She's making the wines now. And they do, they make a Bourgogne white and red that's just, it's under $20
retail. Oh, that's
retail,
a great price point.
Or around there. And it's, they work biodynamically and are doing, they do everything right. It's really like light, fresh, and really enjoyable.
Is there another thing like Bourgogne?
Yeah. So another I was going to say is Bourgogne Pâte Haute Grande is another.
Is that the maker or?
No, it's the region. It's a blend of Gamay and Pinot Noir, whereas Burgundy is always Pinot Noir.
We're going to try a Gamay in a few minutes.
Yeah.
So tell it to me again. It's
Bourgogne, so it's
Pasta.
Yeah, and then Pasta Tote Grand is P. I think it's PASTETOUTGRAIN.
Okay.
Spelling
is that
there.
Readily but available? Can
yeah,
you go
yeah,
into a good wine store
in
New York?
In New York, you can definitely find it.
What's the price point on that?
And it's around 20,
okay.
I would say. And from a good producer, it's really, I think it's definitely worth it. Groffier is a great producer. It's Groffier.
Yeah.
And his Pasta Tote Grand is 90% Pinot from actually Premier Cru Vineyards, which are the highest.
So that's a fair way to break into Burgundy.
Yeah.
Grab some good wines from some good makers, yeah. Compliment some food, and wow your friends.
Yeah.
Hey, I brought wines from Burgundy.
Yeah. And I think Marcenais is another area to look at. So that's a village that is still pretty value-driven. And when you find... The years are important too. So 2012, the,
right?
Is,
like any is a, vintage yeah. year, some are
and
better 13s, than others.
I mean, 14.
Wait, so give me in the last 4 or 5 years mm-hmm. the best vintages.
Well, they're all good, but they're different. So it's like if you're looking for maybe 2011 tends to be a little bit lighter and a little more herbaceous, whereas 2012 has a little more density to it. The 13s too, the fruit quality to me is always a little bit juicier and darker. And 14s are the current release, so those are the ones coming to market. And for whites and reds, it's great. There's just there's a little more structure and kind of the acidity is quite prominent. So the whites especially are very good.
It's crazy how mm-hmm. the characteristics vary.
Yeah, they
to
really
vintage.
Do. I mean, Burgundy is definitely intimidating. It was the first. I mean, I was super intimidated to get into it. But once you delve in, it's hard to back out.
All right, enough of the Burgundy stuff. I know you look for sort of under-the-radar wines and wine regions. I think the list prides itself on spreading out into some of those places. Tell me, like you told me about some of the Burgundies, tell me about some cool wine regions, not necessarily new, but new, or mm-hmm. things that excite you, that are you're serving at the restaurant that you're drinking.
Yeah, sure. I mean, Loire is definitely one that... I really love. And
so Loire is a region in France, like Bordeaux and Burgundy.
Mm-hmm.
And let's talk about some of the wines that excite you that come out of there.
Yeah. I mean, so Bernard Baudry is a producer.
B-E-A-U-D-R-Y.
Mm-hmm. And Chinon. Chinon is the region. It's C-H-I-N-O-N. So they do...
That's a red wine.
And it's mostly red. Cabernet Franc is the grape. Has a really long history as a region of winemaking. And the Baudry wines are some that I've always really enjoyed. And, you know, it's great because, you know, at the same time you're supporting a family. It's,
right.
was started by Bernard in the late 70s, early 80s. And youngest in the family, he wasn't able to acquire the family vine, so he kind of found his own and has always been working with a natural approach and focusing on single vineyards. And their reds are great and some are really good value, like the Lagrange retail, like, it's around $20 as well. And they do some really great whites too, actually, recently.
Nice.
So I always like those wines.
Any other regions? So you have the Loire.
And the Rhone. I love Rhone. I love Syrah. So Northern Rhone and Southern Rhone, but for me, Northern Rhone is kind of where it's at for
You're
me.
More of a Northern.
Yeah, I like the Syrahs.
Right.
So.
All right. So we do a thing here called the wine list, and I didn't prep you on this. It's spontaneous. I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions because
okay.
I'm curious what experts like you are drinking and thinking. So I'm going to ask you about 5 or 6 questions. Don't dwell on them. Try to answer them. There's no right or wrong answer. So what wine are you drinking right now? What do you keep going back to?
Mm-hmm. I usually don't have anything this... Well, right now at home I have a Jamais Côte de Rhône 14 open on the kitchen counter.
That's
that
a great wine.
Yesterday. So It's a good wine, and it's more money than I usually spend on wine. But
great
another that I've been drinking often as kind of a house wine, I have Lafarge Pasta Tocron. So again, that example, and it's the 2012, and that one's, you know, it's more like.
So you're a Rhone fan.
I do like Rhone. Mm-hmm.
All right, your favorite wine and food pairing. You know, everybody says champagne and oysters, fine. But what is a favorite wine and food pairing?
I mean,
what makes you smile?
There's the one that I eat a lot is just my husband and I, we make, he cooks roasted chicken every week pretty much.
And what do you pair with
and
that?
And I drink Beaujolais with it. So.
Okay, so roasted chicken and Beaujolais. Mm-hmm. And Beaujolais is a terrific value wine.
Yes, it is.
Exclude Pearl and Ash and Rebel. Mm-hmm. Favorite wine restaurant or wine bar?
Company, Sir Naturel.
Where's that?
I always walk there, but I forget exactly. It's on Center Street.
Okay.
Center
it's downtown
Street.
Manhattan.
Yeah, off of Lafayette. And Caleb Ganser and the crew over there, they're awesome. And the wine list is really fun to kind of drink through.
All right. What about favorite all-time wine?
Year I turned 30.
If you give me an answer, it doesn't have to be number one, but what's one of your favorite?
The first one that is pretty recent, I turned 30 in August, and Patrick very, very graciously opened a birth year bottle of Rouleau Perrier 1986.
Nice.
This is a really, really special bottle of white Burgundy, and it was absolutely amazing.
It lived up to the hype?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Nice. Did you have a meal with it, or you just drank? Okay. Nice. Tell me the best wine label you've seen.
Oh, the best wine label. The first one that popped into mind actually is sort of Folkway Machine. They work in California and they have some pretty
What's it called?
Folkway Machine.
Folkway Machine.
They do like a lot of different bottlings of things, but the labels are always really colorful and fun and funky.
Cool. Mm-hmm. We'll have to look out for that. All right, last question. Best wine under $15 retail. You're going to a store with a friend. Your friend calls you and says, I need a great bottle of wine, $15.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a red. Give me a white.
I would go for Muscadet, Pepier. The Muscadet is always, like, a really good call. It's always...
And it's around $15?
Yeah, $15. Muscadet, in general, for white wines, tends to be really good value.
And a good food wine.
And a good food wine, great with oysters.
Right.
And then for red... I always like the Lafayette. It's like the guy, the label has a little cartoon guy drinking the jug. It's like Raison something. And it's he's a great producer in Beaujolais, and this is sort of his younger vines, and it's fairly...
So what's it called again?
It's Lafayette.
Lafayette.
And the wine itself is called Raison.
How would you...
Raisins, like
Raisin.
R-A-I-S-A-N-S.
All right, those sound like two good wines. All right, we're going to taste our weekly wine sip, and we're going to taste a Morgon this week. Will you stay with us?
Absolutely.
Taste it with us and help us evaluate it?
Yeah.
All right, let's take a quick break. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
Music for this commercial break is brought to you by TaxStar, and this song is called Relax, It's Just the End of the World.
Are you an East Sider? We live on the east side of town. Our shipping container studios are at Roberta's in Bushwick, across the East River, separating New York City and Brooklyn. In all my recent travels, it seems like the east side of town is the cool side of town in cities across the country. East Nashville is full of musicians and weird bars. The up-and-coming neighborhood around H Street in D.C., on the east side, is overflowing with exciting food and nightlife. The best hidden spots and funky artists in New Orleans are in the Marigny and Bywater, which, yup, is the east side of town. So, as Eastsiders, we love drinks that represent our values. And nothing is more fitting than a cool, refreshing can of Austin Eastsiders. That's Eastsider with a C. As the name implies, it is cider, and it's handmade on, you guessed it, the east side of Austin, Texas, using bittersweet and bittersharp cider apples. Cider apples are full of tannins, adding astringency and complexity of flavor to every sip. Austin Eastsiders uses a mixture of European and Pacific Northwest apples to achieve ultimate flavor. Austin Eastsiders is available in a few different variations, including original flavor, Texas honey, and two new additions, hopped and pineapple. Here at Heritage Radio, we love Austin Eastsiders with some ribs, pulled pork, and even pizza, especially Roberta's pizza. You can find out more at AustinEastSiders.com and remember to hashtag EastSiders to show your East Side pride. You can also find Austin Eastsiders on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
All right, we're back. Every week we taste a different wine on the air. For this week's weekly wine sip, I've asked Kimberly Prokosian from Rebel Wine Bar, from Rebel in New York City, to stay with us and taste with us. She said no, so I had to handcuff her to the chair, and I'm going to force her to drink this. So today, we're tasting a Morgon from France. It's the 2012 Domaine de Versailles Morgon, a red Beaujolais wine from Jean-Claude Debonne. The wine is 100% Gamay grape from the hillside vineyards of Debonne. It's located in the Beaujolais region of France, a district of the Burgundy region. Now, am I correct? Beaujolais is a district of the Burgundy region, Kimberly?
Yeah, okay. Although politically it's Rhone.
Right. I know that.
I've had people ask me about that, because sometimes it says it.
The wine retails for about $16 to $20 and is readily available at larger wine stores. All right, is there anything else about Morgon that you can add?
I would say, so Beaujolais has kind of a bad rap, but Morgon is one of the 10 villages that's considered a cru, classified cru. So the wines tend to be more, more structured and more age-worthy, darker, a little more concentrated, and more kind of nuanced. So there's like more minerality, more spice, more a little more of everything versus...
A lot of people think of Beaujolais as that wine that comes out, is it, around Thanksgiving? It's usually Georges Debove. It's very young and...
Yeah, they make the Nouveau that's done from that year's vintage, and it's...
I don't get that. I mean, is any of that stuff good? I mean, is it fun? I mean, do you guys have it in the restaurant?
We do. Yeah, actually, sometimes. I mean, I don't remember if we definitely have had Beaujolais Nouveau. And I think what it's made for is just kind of quick drinking, glue. You know,
that's not a bad turkey wine, right?
No, it's not like you wouldn't. Traditionally, you wouldn't, although some things have kind of, maybe people would argue with me, there's certain ones maybe you can age, but you wouldn't really want to age that wine.
All right, so we have the 2012 Domaine de Versailles Morgon from Jean-Claude Debonne. Kimberly, let's give it a sniff and a sip. So first, let's look at the color. How is this color for a Morgon?
Yeah.
Light, dark, meat?
I would say it's kind of like a garnet color. It's kind of typical, maybe a little bit darker than...
All right, now, nose.
So...
I'm not getting much. Are you getting anything?
It's like a little like blue-fruited and kind of spicy, maybe like a little pepper, soft pepper.
Yeah, I'm getting a little like cherry kirsch or whatever.
Yeah. There's a little bit of a candied quality to it.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's throw it over the tongue. Medium to light body?
Yeah. Medium to light body.
Not very mouth coating?
No, but moderate acidity, kind of, it's like a little bright.
The acidity is good?
Yeah, I think so.
Good for food?
Yeah. Yeah, it's not overwhelming, but it's definitely present.
Is this fruity to you? Do you pick up cherry, red fruits?
It is to me. like cherry and blueberry, but there is still that spicy character too. That is like an accent almost.
What food would you pair this with?
Well, I would have roasted chicken with it. And
now, we have to mention that Kimberly's husband is a professional chef. So when this dude's making a chicken, making a chicken. It isn't like my Aunt Seal's dried chicken. It's like a delicious chicken.
It's delicious.
So this is a perfect match for that.
But,
all right, so how do we grade this wine? I don't love it. We had a Vietti last week, and it was delicious.
Vietti's
this is really good. You know, it's a serviceable wine.
It's serviceable.
At best. And for the price, it's okay.
There's other examples of Margaux that I would
guess that if I left it to you and gave you $20-$25, you'd come back with something a little better than this.
Yeah.
All right, before we get into our final couple of segments, I just wanted to mention, because it's kind of a cool thing, Kimberly pulls out a bottle every night at the restaurant, and Kimberly is pretty social media savvy, so she Instagrams what they're drinking. Tell me quickly about that. I have a buddy, Michael Madrigal, who did a big bottle program at Balloon Suit, and he would take pictures and all of that.
Yeah.
I see similarities in that. So just tell me about that program quickly.
Yeah. We do it because I wanted to have a way that we could sort of share the cellar that we have and make it accessible to guests, where I think sometimes it's hard to commit to one bottle if you're alone or you don't have anyone to dine out with or you only have half an hour. And one of the ways that I really personally like dining at Rebel is at the bar. So I think that the cellar raid really, the idea is that it encourages people to come in, have a bite to eat, and like enjoy a glass of wine that
normally wouldn't be
available.
Bottles,
they're not readily available retail.
I've seen price ranges from $16 to $18 bucks. Great price points.
We make it very fairly priced too. So
every night you can find an interesting bottle of wine at Rebel, and you could follow Kimberly at Wine Kimberly. That's your Instagram handle?
It is, yeah.
And your Twitter handle. All right. Finally, if you want to be the smartest guy in your wine group, take a wine course. There's a bunch of great places in New York City offering wine courses. Our friend Laura Maniac has Cork Buzz Wine Studio. She has two locations in New York. You could get in there and learn some stuff. There's the New York City Wine Company, which is located in Chelsea. They have everything from beginner classes to advanced. There's the New York Vintners on Warren Street. And our upcoming guest, Kevin Zraley, has been running the Windows on the World Wine School for over 40 years. All these classes start at around $50. And the reason you're paying about $50 is because they're pulling some wine out. And you can take a series of multiple classes, 5-6 classes, and those classes run 250 and up. So take some time and look around for a course at one of these places. If you have a wine happening or event and any other information you want to get to me, hit me up at Sam at the Grape Nation. That's Sam at the Grape Nation. And also, we're going to be posting on our Instagram account, S. Ben Ruby. We're going to be posting Kimberly's choices for the wine list. So look for that in the next day or so. All right. Thank you, Kimberly Precocian, head sommelier of Rebel in New York City. Get down there and look for Kimberly. Thanks to everyone at the Heritage Radio Network. Go to heritageradionetwork.org for more info. And thank you again to our engineer, Pierre. We'll see you next week. Thank you.
This program's theme music is brought to you by The Groutet, and this track is called Tinder, eh?
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.